This is XTP Media.
You're listening to Extended. Your hosts, Peter Johnson from XTP Media, Gareth Stringer from Global Aviation Resource, and Tim Robinson from the Royal Aeronautical Society.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson, and welcome to episode 68 of Aerospace Radio Station Extended. Today, I'm joined by Tim Robinson from the Royal Aeronautical Society, and Tim, of course, is the Editor-in-Chief of Aerospace Magazine. Tim, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you, Peter. Good to be back in the saddle.
Yep, it's been a while. Thank you very much to you and Gareth for holding the fort. Sadly, it took us a very long time to coordinate diaries to get today's recording date, but Gareth has had to be called away on a domestic emergency, so our very best wishes go to Gareth at this challenging time. But we do, however, have a guest host, and we're welcoming back Ed Skio from Sim155, and we're going to talk all about Combat Air Patrol 2. That is, of course, the Flight Naval Combat Simulator with a mission planner and fully dynamic open-ended campaign, which features the AV-8B Harrier 2. I don't know much about that, but I'm looking forward to it. So, Ed, welcome back to Extended.
Hi, Peter. Thanks for having me back. It's good to be back.
We had a challenge last time. The line dropped out on us a few times, so the interview didn't really come through. But we are absolutely delighted to have you back and see if we can find out a bit more about CAP 2. I'm looking forward to that. We've got a packed show. We've got some feedback promoting aerospace. We're going to talk books. But let's get started by what's caught our eye in the news. Okay, Tim, we can't start the news section without talking about the AAIB report from Shoreham. Very sad, of course, the event that occurred a few years ago. We've already felt the impact of it, but everyone's been eagerly awaiting the report. And as expected, I think, the finger by the AAIB has been pointed to the manoeuvre that the aircraft was coming out of, and it's believed now that the aircraft was too slow and too low for the manoeuvre it was undertaking. What else do we know about the AAIB and its report?
Well, I mean, I think we've got to be a little bit careful here and just clarify that the AAIB, it's an accident investigation agency, and it does not apportion blame. So it's purely factual. It's done the investigation, and the conclusion it's come to obviously was too low coming into the manoeuvre in the first place, and the Hunter was at the top of the loop, pulling over. So it's not a criminal investigation. It's not anything like that. It's just purely factual. But yeah. It's no surprise to the people who were following it from the inside that would be the following it from the outside that would be the summary.
The finding. Is it unusual for the AAIB to talk about, I suppose, some of the wider issues? I mean, they found some parts of the aircraft that were past their due bite day for inspection and maintenance. We expected that, although it's very clear that they didn't contribute to this, or it's not known that they contributed to it. But the AAIB does talk a lot about risk management. And of course, the Civil Aviation Authority is now on that case. And I suppose that's the impact that we're feeling on air shows in the UK.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's safe to say that the Shoreham crash was such a epoch-changing accident for UK vintage aviation, for UK air shows, that it has had got wider ramifications, and there are now things where obviously we were looking at last year we had some safety tightened up, some air shows didn't go ahead because they had to introduce new rules, so that there's very much been a spotlight thrown on the sector.
Yeah,
and some hard questions asked in some cases about is everything being done that can be done and that should be done? Are people current enough? And these have been addressed, and there are sort of changes coming.
Yeah, and the impact has been, I suppose, less so on some of the military air shows. Sadly, we've seen a few again disappear, but just wanted to put you on the spot. We've got REAC coming up. Of course, we've got the Naval Air Show at Yeovilton coming up. Quite excited about both of those. We got the Thunderbirds coming over. Anything else you're looking forward to this year in terms of the air show circuit?
This year it's going to be sort of Paris.
Oh yes,
Paris Air Show. Yep. So I'll be off to that. Mitsubishi MRJ is going to appear in Paris.
Right. Okay. Which
could be quite interesting. There was also maybe the H160 from Airbus Helicopters. They said they're quite busy with that, but they haven't made up their mind. But that could be making its debut at an air show.
Right, I'm going to come back and ask you about that, because I know you've been out to see Airbus Helicopters, but I'll hold my tongue.
I'd just like to say, with regard to the air shows, I go each year to the Sunderland Air Show, and all the flights are done over the sea, so there's something like 250,000 people go to that show. All the aerobatics, etc., is all done 100 meters from the coast.
Yeah,
and the future we'll see more of that kind of show.
Yeah, I think there's a push to do more of that. But even that was called into question. I know there was a lot of tittle tattle on social media about other aircraft, including the pilot involved in the Shoreham incident, coming very close to the shore. So they are under scrutiny as well, but I do believe you could be right there. Sadly, though, we've seen a few of those disappear from the circuit as well, and they've been, quarter of a million people. It's just amazing. So we've really, really got to keep up the pressure within the industry to make sure we do these safely, but we keep these events going ahead.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, let's move on to another story that's burning the papers and social media at the moment. The UK bans laptops and tablets on flights from 6 Middle Eastern countries. Nothing larger than a smartphone allowed in cabins on planes from Turkey, Lebanon, Jordan, Egypt, Tunisia and Saudi Arabia. Also, 6 UK airlines, BA, EasyJet, Jet2, Monarch, Thomas Cook and Thompson, as well as some foreign carriers, are affected. Now, Tim, this has got everybody rattled, predominantly because the US ban is very much vaguer than the UK ban, and they say anything, quote-unquote, anything larger than a smartphone. And their ban is slightly different. Theirs only applies to 9 Middle Eastern, North African and Turkish airlines, and specific to 10 airports. What's going on here? Why the difference? Shouldn't it just be a blanket ban for everyone?
If you know what's going on, please tell someone in authority, and we can get this sorted out. This has come out of obviously the US ban was introduced. Announced at short notice. I think the first notice of it was a tweet from Royal Jordanian, who was sort of released it kind of early. There's a lot of problems with that. Firstly, it's not the differing slightly differing rules between the US and UK. They're only going to kind of confuse people even more. I mean, at least with liquids, if you're flying in the US, you're flying in Europe, liquids, right? Okay, liquids under 100 meters, and even then there's still people who
milliliters,
forget
yeah.
And they, that they'll get on that. So everyone knows that sort of a blanket that rule, that blanket rule, or that you have to take your shoes off, or this, it seems as, you know, designed to confuse people as to you know, what's going on. Some of the airports mentioned in the US, restrictions, you know, Dubai. One of the safest world's airports, Abu Dhabi as well. Abu Dhabi, you actually get screened by US customs before you actually get on the plane.
Tim, a cynic would say, not me, of course, but a cynic might say, is this the new administration putting a little bit of pressure on the ME3?
It's difficult to say. I think there is. I mean, back in February 2016, there was a attempt to bring down an airliner. It was in Somalia, I believe, flying to or from Mogadishu. It was detonated. The person, it was smuggled through, got airside. Someone took it on board. The suicide bomber. Bomber decided to set it off. Got sucked out for his troubles of a little hole in the aircraft outside of the fuselage. Plane landed safely.
We did also have in 2015 the airliner in Egypt as well, and I think the Americans also quoted the armed attacks in Brussels and Istanbul as well. So I think there is a blanket justification, but there's obviously some intelligence sitting some behind specifics. This. Yeah,
but I think Ed, you were pointing this out earlier about the safety v security thing about lithium ion batteries. Last year, the FAA was talking about don't put your lithium ion batteries, don't put your laptops in the cargo hold.
Yeah, I mean, if a laptop or whatever, its battery goes off in the cabin, at least the crew can safely control that. If it goes off in the holds, then it's a much more dangerous situation for the plane, isn't it? So I don't like the idea of thousands of lithium-ion batteries suddenly being transported in passenger aircraft holds. It's
it doesn't feel right, which tends to suggest that the intelligence is suggesting that there needs to be a human intervention to make whatever happens happen, or whatever could happen take place. And of course, you know, as you said, Tim, in 2016, the airliner, I think was it an Airbus or a 737?
It was an Airbus, wasn't it?
And that was a pretty clean punch it made through the side of that. That aircraft, so it probably has something to do with that. Well, we'll see how this unfolds. I know there are other countries looking to adopt the ban, so let's see if the confusion continues or whether there's some synergy somewhere. Interestingly, just before we leave this topic, though, I did say I wasn't a cynic, but I will just throw this one in. None of the airports are in the countries covered by the Trump administration's travel ban. So, you know, I'm sure I thought he might have taken that opportunity to double up, shall we say. But there you go. Better move on. Keep politics out of the aviation podcasts. Tim, I said I'd get back to you on this. You have just been down to somewhere very exciting, haven't you? Tell us about Airbus helicopters.
Okay, yeah. So this was a visit a couple of weeks ago now, down to Marianne in the south of France.
See, it's a hard life. It's a hard life working for the Royal Aeronautical Society.
And that's where Airbus helicopters, their HQ is there, factory there. Flight test, very interesting airport to visit anyway, because that's where the guard security. They have the water bombers for the French French water bombers, kind of are based as well. Really interesting stuff in that a lot of aerospace companies these days are taking cues from the tech industry. Everybody, whether Airbus, Boeing, you name it. They all want to be Apple, Google, Facebook, or some combination thereof. So being shown around a new innovation center there, they'd put all the engineers in there, about 1,000 engineers. And it was very kind of Google-like in the idea that we put lots of coffee spots here.
Yeah, lots of breakout areas and things I read in the article. Yeah.
This is where the engineers can chat and maybe they'll come up with some new magic and come up, you know, and mix things up. And also the idea that you'd do these very, very short, sharp projects. So you'd say, you know, that lasts from a week to, say, 3 months. And you'd say to some small team, right, okay, you know, we want to see advanced landing gear, you know, and they got it for, a month.
Yeah.
And
is this where this terminology fail fast, fail often comes from? I think that was this new mantra.
It's from the Silicon Valley. So it's a very sort of Silicon Valley. It's interesting. It's a very sort of Silicon Valley approach for, you know, a quite conservative industry. You know, I mean, helicopter pilots tend to be pessimists. And the helicopter, you know, the helicopter industry, it's focused on, you know, safety first, and do anything too radical. But yet, in the innovation, in what's on the future, you know, these guys are kind of trying to, it doesn't matter if we fail,
yeah,
because we learned something. So it's quite interesting.
Well, as many of our listeners know, I've been lucky enough to feature two retirements of helicopters, the Jungly and most recently the Lynx, of course. And on both occasions, I got to go up in a Jungly and also in a Chinook, actually.
Ah.
And I've got to say, I used to think helicopter pilots were slightly balmy. And I think a lot of fixed-wing individuals do. But hats off to these guys. I mean, what they can do with these helicopters is nothing short of quite amazing. So really, really enjoyed that experience. But I will also add, just before I come back to you, Tim, I've also just heard probably the funniest aviation story I've ever heard on an Australian Rotary podcast. I'll put a link into it. And it's called The Chicken Bone Story, and I will leave it there. So coming back to Airbus, I mean, it's not a name synonymous with helicopters, but they do have this flagship project, the H-160. Tell us a little bit about that.
Okay, so Airbus helicopters, so that's their new name. That used to be Eurocopter, Aerospatiale, you know, all back through the good old days. So they've got a long heritage, you know. The H-160 is probably their latest flagship. It's a medium helicopter. Looks the business outside. First application is probably kind of VIP stroke corporate market, and actually it's going to the French military are going to buy a whole load. It's going to replace Gazelles, Alouettes, Panthers in the French Air Force, Army, and Navy as a sort of light stroke medium multi role. So really nice looking aircraft, and talk with the test pilot, really nice handling as well. Very, very quiet. He was saying that they were doing hover taxiing for a test flight, and the squirrel that was hover taxiing behind him, chase aircraft, was actually louder than what he could hear, you know, louder than his helicopter.
Wow. And Tim, just generally, we seem to be seeing some of the smaller aircraft leave various military inventories. Is there a drive for helicopters to move more into that medium bracket? And if so, why? Is the light support helicopter no longer viable?
I don't think that the
you know, the Gazelle, you know, obviously there were some of the really light.
Well, like the Gazelles at the Empire Test Pilot School in the UK, they're going to be replaced by H-125s, which are the new name for the squirrel.
Right,
with
okay.
a glass cockpit.
Yeah.
I don't think so. I mean, another interesting sort of trend there from Airbus helicopters is their H-Force weapons system, which basically turns out anything from a squirrel to a Super Puma into an attack helicopter. And the idea is you can put these gun pods or rockets and even, you know, guided missiles on anything from a basically commercial models, what were commercial models. You strengthen them, you put the wiring in on the production line, and hey presto, if you've got a targeting sight and a sensor system, sensor ball, and you've got a 20 millimeter cannon attached to an aircraft, a helicopter as small as a squirrel, you've got your own sort of dedicated little mini attack helicopter, and that's perfect for some of these coin wars, anti-insurgency stuff that we're seeing, where people, maybe an Apache or a Tiger is just sheer overkill. A lot of nations can't afford that. A dedicated attack helicopter that really should be going after tanks.
And Tim, what, just before we leave Airbus helicopters then, one that caught my eye just at the end of your article, and we'll put a link in the show notes to that, is this UAV, the VSR 700, the Gabry G2 light helicopter conversion. Airbus believe they've got a real opportunity there, no direct competitors. Is it light? Is it cheap? Does that fit the bill of what you were just talking about, where, it's just too expensive to have these big heavy attack helicopters?
That's a naval UAV.
Right.
And one of the things that obviously Europe has sort of lagged a bit in UAVs, you think of any UAV, at least in military UAVs, Predator, Reaper, and maybe Israeli UAVs as well. So Europe's really lagged behind. And this might be an interesting naval niche. It's being supported by a naval engineering company as well. So probably that means the first customer will be, I would guess here, it's not been announced yet, but it would be the French Navy, or at least trialed with the French Navy. And it sort of sits in between the smaller camcopter type UAVs, which have been sold around the world, and the larger Fire Scout, which the US Navy has, which is now the size of a size of a Jet Ranger, the latest B version. There's an interesting thing of their interesting sort of niche. I think it's about 10 hours endurance, to go on the back of a ship.
Yeah. Pretty impressive stuff.
I was actually
thinking
of adding those to Combat Air Patrol.
Wow.
I have the 3D models already. So
wow.
Be something in the campaign mode where you can send a UAV helicopter to go and recon an area.
Oh, wow.
Wow, that'd be cool. That'd be cool. Well, let's hold that thought. Two more news items just before we go out of this segment. Very relevant today, news that quietly crept up on us, and that is that the C-Series, the CS-100, has been flight testing in the UK, flew into Stansted a few days ago as we record, and has been working at London City, or London Lucy Airport, as it's becoming known. It's done its 8 qualification flights in and out of there, and Bombardier is saying that it's the one aircraft designed very specifically for airports like London City. And I know Swiss Air are very keen to bring their new aircraft into London City. But the thing that caught my eye from this is that as the test aircraft departed London City, she flew direct to New York. Now, how cool is that? Out of London City, right from the centre of London, right into New York. It doesn't really get any better than that from an airline's perspective.
I would have thought BA would be buying some of those for their
at the end of one of the articles. End of one of the articles I was reading, that very, very proposition had been put, can they fly direct out of there without that stopover now? Could be a real showstopper, that, if they could do that. Not the biggest aircraft in the world, but certainly big enough to have a decent load capacity. I'm sure that would be a great revenue earning service direct. Any thoughts on that, Tim? Have you seen the C-Series yet?
I saw it at when it made its debut at Paris a couple of years ago. Incredibly quiet. I mean, that was so quiet you had to kind of look up in the air, and if you didn't look up in the air and sort of see it, you would have missed it because it was that quiet. I think it's really interesting that a lot of people are already excited by not only what it could do by London City, but to you know, secondary or tertiary airports in doing these long, thin routes and sort of boosting regional connections. And if you look at where things are heading now, like, you know, the Norwegian now are going to do transatlantic in a 737.
Yeah.
And they're talking about a link up as well with Ryanair. So all of a sudden, like, you know, the idea of going like transatlantic in a narrow body.
Yeah.
But
it's not very appealing, is it?
It's not very appealing, but there's now people, like, you know, looking and going, well, you know, long haul, low cost. And everyone thought, oh, yeah, long haul, low cost, you know, you need a really big airliner to do it. You know, you need to pack people out with that A380, just fill it to the gunwales, give everyone, everyone pack, you know, as many people as you can into an A380, then it might work. And what it turns out is that the new generation of very, very efficient aircraft means, you know, that people are looking at longer and longer routes with narrow bodies, you know, 737, the A320, A321 yeah. LR, that as well. Sort of the older routes that I suppose you'd put a 757 on.
Yeah. Well,
I've flown a transatlantic and a 757. I found that not as comfortable as a A330 or a 747, et cetera. So
yeah, that was just the point I was going to make. I mean, I love the 757. I love the sound of it. I love the look of it. Yeah. But transatlantic, you know, I know in the States going West Coast to East Coast or reverse, it's quite common. But I suppose over the sea, I don't know, it just has a very different very different feeling. But the cabin layout on the CS100 is 2 and 3, isn't it, Tim? So I suppose it might feel slightly different than the 3+3 seating.
Yeah, I mean it's had the benefit of you know, kind of obviously modern materials, modern design, and it feels a lot bigger than the actual, you know, aircraft.
Sadly terribly hit by delays and cost overruns and those sorts of things. But I tell you what, fair cop to Bombardier, very impressed by that, and it really will open London City up with aircraft like that. Really change, game changer. Okay, final story. We're coming to you, Ed. European Space Agency, we haven't had a space story for a very long time, but this one's very relevant, have just recently launched a new satellite, Sentinel 2. Why is that important?
Well, already ESA launched Sentinel 2A, and that was mapping the planet at a 10-meter resolution, and they'd made that data available to anyone to use.
What, it's open source?
Yeah, sure.
Right, okay.
Which is great.
Yeah, for people like you.
yes, absolutely. And that would map the whole planet every 10 days. So now they've launched Sentinel 2B, which means we'll be mapping the planet every 5 days between visits. So it's cool if you want to see changes in whatever, you know, fire or whatever, you can see, you know, the extent of those regions.
And what sort of applications? I mean, that's a massive amount of data, Ed, flying around, and I suppose we're becoming more used to that in today's society. But what sort of practical applications does it have? I mean, you say it's open source. Who are the sorts of people using it?
Me. So in Combat Air Patrol 2, I'm now adjusting the way the terrain is rendered to use satellite imagery. So with the Sentinel 2 data, I need satellite imagery which is taken around about noon, so there's no shadows cast
right
across the terrain.
Yeah.
So I need effectively illuminated terrain, but not from an angle. I don't want cloud cover, obviously, because then you'd see the clouds actually on the terrain in the game. So basically, I can look through each of these 10-day apart captures of the regions I'm interested in, looking for low cloud cover and a visit time of around about noon at that location. So it's fantastic for developers like myself, anyone who's doing Earth observation applications. Yeah, 10-meter resolution is cool.
Ed, excuse my ignorance in this. How easy is it to access this data from EASA then? Do you literally just download the files?
Yeah, you go to their website, register once. Then it's a case of mapping out the area you're interested in, and a query against their database of footage, and then you can set what kind of cloud level you're interested in, or your minimum cloud level, maximum cloud level, and then you can just download from any of the results that they give you. You can decide, you can see thumbnails of those areas, and then download the much higher resolution full and sets of data.
And given that a large portion of something like SIM-155's work is going to be on military stuff, how do they have security protection on that? Because I presume you'd want, you know, airfields, runways and things like that. How do they protect that from a privacy perspective?
Well, there's no protection with this data, because this goes down to 10-meter resolution. If you look on Google Maps, you can go down to approximately 1-foot resolution. So
there's more of an issue with security
with Google Maps than there is with this data.
Right, okay. So Big Brother's out there watching us. If he's not, Ed will be. So, and on that note, we'll take a break. And after the break, Tim's going to talk to Ed about Combat Air Patrol 2.
From across the globe, from the centre of aerospace, and now to you.
The Royal Aeronautical Society has a range of specialist groups which focus on a specific domain or discipline. They form a vital interface between the society and the world at large, and serve both the interests of enthusiasts and professionals through debate, conferences, lectures, and other activities. Learn how you can get involved. Visit www.aerosociety.com.
Okay, so for this episode of Extended, we welcome back Ed. Ed Scio from SIM-155. Now, before I start quizzing Ed, well, let's talk a little bit about Combat Air Patrol 2. It's a Harrier AV-8B sim. It comes along with the holy grail of holy grails, a dynamic campaign. Puts you off the coast of a in the Gulf.
Straits of Hormuz.
The Straits of Hormuz. And ask you to basically get on with it. So, Ed, welcome to the show again.
Thanks.
Starting off with tell us about sort of SIM-155 and CAP 2 in a nutshell, in a better nutshell than what I've just described it as.
I mean, back in the 90s, I was writing flight simulators, and I left that industry, but came back to it a couple of years ago to write Combat Air Patrol 2. So I formed the company SIM-155 to publish CAP 2 and possibly CAP 3, etc. So basically, I design and code the simulation. It's not a 20, 30, 40, 50 man team or anything. It's basically myself and an artist. So, SIM-155. 155 is the actual longitude and latitude of where I'm from, which you can probably tell from my accent is in the northeast of England, not Scotland. SIM-155, we'll be producing flight sims, another simulating-based games over the next few years.
Cool. What made you choose the Harrier for CAP 2? Because for anyone who doesn't know flight simulators. The jet, flight simulators were really popular in the 1990s, kind of died off a bit, and now, well, died off over the last, sort of, I don't know, decade or so, maybe of uh, to, to you know just a couple really. So it's been quite a while since we've had anyone to actually launch a new modern jet combat sim, isn't it?
Yeah, sure. But yeah, I mean, I chose the Harrier because it's just such an iconic aircraft, so versatile, and it's also battle proven in the Gulf War in Operation Iraqi Freedom. It's fun to fly. As soon as you try a VTOL flight, yeah, that gets your attention as you're trying to fly it. Yeah, it's just an interesting aircraft. It's versatile, does things other planes can't do. Yeah, that's the Harrier.
Was it particularly difficult in capturing the VTOL flight? I know. I mean, I've flown it. I've flown it. I've got a hot asset home set up, and it really does sort of, to me, not a Harrier pilot, but I have sort of spoken with Harrier pilots, including one Harrier test pilot, and it just feel exactly like is described in the books of that inertia and kind of balancing on a pencil that people sort of talk about. Was it difficult to kind of get the data or try and model it and to when
with regard to modeling it, I mean, there's a lot of data out there now. When I first wrote Combat Patrol 1, there was no data other than some books you could get hold of. I remember I was writing letters off to the Department of Defense in the US to get information on their carriers, which they actually replied and sent me pictures and some information, which was great, but that was taking weeks. now it's basically Google search, and you've got reference material, you've got pictures, videos, documents, describing things in detail. So yeah, it's very easy to get hold of, well, for the older planes, it's very easy to get hold of all the reference material that you need. But then actual programming it was relatively simple because I think when people try to put VTOL planes into things like Flight Simulator, Microsoft Flight Simulator, the flight models on those programs don't handle vectored thrust, so yeah, you have to do all sorts of workarounds with the flaps and settings, I think, to try and shoehorn a VTOL flight model into that program. Whereas this is written from scratch, so it was relatively trivial, really, for me to develop the vectored thrust. So from that point of view, it's a lot more work writing things from scratch. At least you can develop them exactly how it's needed.
And in kind of, for people wanting a combat flight simulator today, these days, it seems to have a drop into two stools. There's either the hardcore, DCS, Falcon BMS, where it's 300-page manuals, almost as close as the real thing, lots of flicking switches. Or you've got Ace Combat, and it's a little bit arcade. Where does sort of Cap 2 fit in that scale?
I think we're aiming for a kind of a middle ground. So we have, we're not going to need a 300-page manual to get you flying. But also, we don't want to do arcade level where you might have like 20 missiles on your plane, which is totally unrealistic. We'll still be doing simulation things, such as I think the recent things I did was the radar simulation. So the program actually simulating the tracking of the radar antenna in the nose of the plane through how many bars of radar sweep it's doing, variable azimuth, different radar PRF, pulse repetition frequency settings. It's not overly simple and not overly complex. It's we're going for somewhere in the middle ground.
So it's kind of like use the right tactics and control wingman properly you should get a kind of quite realistic experience then.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, that's exactly it.
And the other thing that obviously has grabbed many people's eyes is the dynamic campaign. Now it's important to point out at this point, folks, that Cap 2 is a work in progress, isn't it? So everything's not quite there just yet.
We're in early access. So that means early access means you can publish your product without everything being 100% at that point. Dynamic campaign will follow the single missions, which are going to working on at the moment. So once all that works, we'll enable the dynamic campaign.
So with the dynamic campaign, you're going to be able to kind of control your Harrier, obviously your Harrier, the Wingman, the ships. Did I hear you say UAVs earlier?
Yeah, well, I have the models for UAVs, so it does take a little bit of time to add them. So, they're on the list of things to add. So, I mean, I'm going to be developing this program for constantly updating it, I think, for at least another year. Once I've got the major points, such as like multiplayer, the campaign enabled, then I'll keep refining it and add extra aircraft, such as the UAVs.
Fantastic.
Ed, can I just jump in there? I think for the older generation out there, I think some of them remember US Navy fighters. That was always my favourite flight sim. Shoot 'em up flight sim, and this one just has that and loads and loads and loads more. When you talk about updating it and amending it and adding new things, I'm not much of a gamer these days. How does that work? Is that how things are done these days? You used to buy a CD, whack it in a machine, and you were off, and you'd get the odd download, the odd additional aircraft or something. But I'm surprised when you made that comment about I'll be continually updating it. How does one go about buying this, and how does continual updates work?
Yeah, well, if you buy the game on the Steam platform, that gives you, as a developer, a simple method to update the program. These might be tiny updates, 1 or 2 megabytes, but it might add an extra plane or whatever. So it's the update process is simple. It's from the point of the user. It's basically you'll get a little message saying Captura is updated, and you go in, run it, and then you can see what's different. So the old days where you would buy a CD and it would be a finished program, it seems like it's 100 years ago that anyone would actually release something that was finished and not expect updates to come through continually. So it actually makes me think years ago it was much harder to actually finish a program and release it because it had to be basically complete. Virtually nothing you buy now, if you've anything from Adobe, say, you'll constantly be getting updates from Adobe, and no one releases a finished program anymore, which is never going to be updated.
I suppose the other thing that I was going to ask then, can I, if I was to buy this and fly it, could I fly it against something else, somebody else? Do I go on the internet and have integrated features like that?
That's one of the updates. That's one of the major updates to come, is multiplayer. So once that's through, there'll actually be a beta test version first, which you can opt into. So if you want to opt into the multiplayer beta, that'll let us see the stability of the first version of multiplayer. And once we're happy with that, then we'll push it to the main default version of the program, which you, when you buy it, that's the version that you download. Because at the moment, you can opt into a VR beta, or you can just opt into another beta channel, which gives you more updates with the potential that there may be some issues with them. Once we're happy those updates work, then we push them through to the main version of the program. So this is all on the Steam platform, which makes this kind of thing nice and simple to manage.
That'll be my next question, actually, on VR, actually, because obviously, along with the dynamic campaign, I think Cap 2 really does sort of shine in VR, particularly the judging a distance from the a distance from the carrier coming in and landing or take off from a carrier in VR and looking around and going, whoa, I'm on a salt carrier here.
Yeah.
Really, really, Was it difficult to integrate kind of VR and get it working correctly?
I mean, the principles behind the VR is very simple, but it's just the first time you're adding it to the program, you'll get things like, as you look up in VR, the view looks down, or as you look left, it'll look right. And that makes sense you so nauseous so quickly. Until those trivial initial kind of bugs are fixed, you'd be playing it for a few minutes and then having to go lie down and keep a bucket next to the desk. And because, yeah, you get quite nauseous when things like that happen. But yeah, the actual technical side of implementing it is very simple. But yeah, until it looks correct, it was, yeah, I felt ill for a week, I think, developing that section.
But I must admit,
yeah, basically. I remember when I used TrackIR for the first time with landing. I'm terrible at landing it, the plane anyway. I'm not a pilot. With TrackIR, it made it a lot easier. But then VR made it a lot easier than TrackIR. So now I can actually get it on the deck and not break the plane every time.
And air-to-air refueling as well in sidling up to that 767 in VR and hooking the basket, that is incredible as well, as to kind of, whoa, I'm here and look, you know. The probe comes out, you know, and amazing.
Well, when I was first developing that, I hadn't coded the refueling help. So that's what either slows you down or speeds you up, trying to drag you towards the basket. So I was actually trying to connect to the basket during development, and the concentration was unbelievable. I would be exhausted after doing a couple of hours of this work because I'm trying to fly the plane to check things connect correctly and things like that. And I was absolutely drained. I think coding the refueling help helped me actually develop the refueling sequence. It was fun.
Okay, so in terms of what's upcoming in the development, so we've got multiplayer, so that's on the way, and that's going to be like kind of force on force with the fleets, isn't it? Where people be able to battle their fleets. You've got satellite terrain, more satellite terrain. You've got the targets coming, and interestingly, in your last blog, you said regions MCS Yuma Cherry Point. Yeah. Plus the Mac Loop in Wales.
Oh, yeah. I watched so much footage of the planes flying through the Mac Loop. And, once I saw that, I thought, yeah, I've got to get that in the game. That's pretty cool.
So does this mean RAF Harriers, Sea Harriers, or F-35s at some point?
Well, it'll still be AV-8Bs to begin with. But at some point in the road map, there's extra planes, but for now it'll just be, yeah, we'll bring in that region, basically most of Wales, and there's going to be a mode in this where you have a bunch of waypoints through the loop, and you've got to fly between them, and you'll get a time and an average height above ground. So, you know, you might get a mission where you have to keep no more than 500 foot above the ground, and you've got to hit each of these waypoints, and there'll be like a list of pilots and best times through those. So I think, because I wanted to implement that after I saw a picture of some board an airfield nearby where each of the pilots, you know, there was like Dutch pilots, US pilots, British pilots, their names were there with their times. The loop, so it's not a gimmick at all. It's actually what the pilots have actually done. So I think
fantastic.
That'd be pretty cool to add.
Mac Loop, the Mac Loop in VR and Harrier.
Yeah,
top gear board, brilliant.
Yeah, sure. On the Steam platform, we have the Cap 2 forum where people can post questions or requests. Actually, one other area I want to add is it's a similar thing, the Mac loop in the US. It's called, I think they call it the Jedi Transition, which is, it sounds pretty cool. It's another kind of canyon kind of area where the plate, Navy planes fly through. That's something I'd like to add as well. But yeah, any requests, if there are any reasonable requests, I'll put them on my to-do list. Yeah, because I want as many ideas as possible, basically, to add to the game. So it's great when people spend enough time with it and want to see extra features. I'm happy to do them if they're reasonable.
And what's the following on from that point? What's the response then from Cap 2 from the flight sim community? Simmers. Notoriously kind of picky community, hard to please, rivet counters and what have you, and get very upset if something isn't quite right. Is it winning a lot of fans?
Yeah, I think it's a very positive response. A couple of not very positive responses too, but in general positive. So I think the flight sim community is quite keen to have more options of things to play. They don't just want to fly DCS only or flight simulator. It's quite an underserved genre. So the overriding sense I get of people is they want the program to succeed and deliver on everything it's got lined up. So that's great. It's a nice feeling. I'll get people saying, comments like, the hopes and prayers of the flight sim community want this to, and I was like, oh, no pressure. But yes, it's good to know. But yeah, I will. It's going to be good.
So where can we find you online then? When can we find out about this game? Because I didn't know too much about it until Tim introduced me to it.
The website is sim155.com. There's also combatairpatrol2.com. If you want to look at the store or the forum on Steam, and you go to the Steam platform and just search for Combat Air Patrol 2. It's easy to find. There's lots of images there. Actually, most of the images out there of before we had the satellite imagery put in, which is that update should be coming in about a week's time with the satellite imagery. In the Gulf, at least. Even myself, I look at it sometimes and think, oh, this is cool. And I'm 15,000 feet over the Straits of Hormuz. I'm looking down and it's now a goal, the satellite imagery. And it looks.
So great. What you're saying, Ed, then is I judge book next week off work, eh?
Yeah. Yeah. One thing I'm adding at the moment is OpenStreetMap data. The ESA satellite imagery is there and it's free for anyone to use. OpenStreetMap basically has all the roads, ports around the world, all the towns and rail and different areas for vegetation. So now I'm passing that massive database and adding that to the game. So we'll have buildings and things like that, which are generated from actually this massive open source database. So it's more things you can see in a real world in the game. So it's that's a big step, which is coming in the next couple of weeks.
Wow. So be able to go and bomb your house.
Basically, yeah.
Well, on that note, we'll leave Cap 2 there. We'll put all those links in the show notes as well. We'll make all the references available to the listeners. So stay with us, Ed. We'll take a little break now and we'll get some feedback.
Not another flying magazine. The newsagents are stuffed with them. How can the aviation historian possibly be any different from the rest? Well, for a start, it's not a monthly, but a quarterly. It's compact format, not the usual A4, so it's great for reading in bed, in the bog, or in the bath. It doesn't cover the same old subjects, but tells you stuff you didn't already know. It's designed simply so it's easier to read, with no fussy backgrounds or overlapping images. And it's not in the newsagents at all. So check the website, theaviationhistorian.com, for more info. The Aviation Historian. It really is different from the rest.
Extended. It's time to talk aviation. Email us now. Get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of extended. Aviation questions, suggested topics, or even good old feedback are all welcome.
And so to the get involved and feedback section of the show, thanks to everyone for their really positive feedback on our last episode on the retirement of the Mark 8 Lynx from Royal Navy Service. Particularly like to thank Aircrew Interview, Neil Braden, John Copeland, Mehdi Azaray, our main man Micah, and Navy Lookout for your very complimentary comments. So thank you very much. General reminder to everyone, please do leave us any feedback on iTunes or however you listen to the programme. That feedback's always useful to us and it helps us to promote the programme. On that basis, recently, Mehdi Azaray and Isaac Alexander both listed us in their hashtag tripod top five. And a shout out for Isaac as well. He also named the Airplane Geeks, the UAV Digest, the PaxX podcast, Sky Betty, Runway VC, and the Check Six podcast as his favourites. So thanks again, Isaac. Great supporter of the show. And of course, Mehdi Azaray as well.
So yeah, thanks very much.
Yeah, that's wonderful. It's great to get a bit of positive feedback, particularly as we've not been too diligent on getting the episodes out. So thank you very much for that. We do appreciate it. Let's talk books then, Tim, over to the Aviation Enthusiasts Book Club on Facebook and, of course, Simon. The book of the month is The Swiss Tiger Parallel Flight, number one. And a quick overview of that. This is the author and photographer's fourth aviation title. But his first on his own. Follows on from two books on the Hawker Hunter and the Mirage 3RS. This new publication spotlights the Swiss Air Force's F-5 Tiger aircraft. It's a unique book, absolutely beautifully produced, lavishly photographed and superbly written, and it's recommended as an absolute must for any aviation fan. Fantastic book. So that's the book of the month on the book club on Facebook. I'm just reading Lightning Boys by Richard Pike. Really having a great time flicking through those stories. I'm just reading a story about a Lightning F6 pilot who took the Lightning over 80,000 feet when they were on exercise in Singapore and over in the Far East. I never knew the aircraft could go that far, that high, Tim.
Well, they trialled against U-2s, yeah.
They were actually doing exercises against the, is it the WB-70, the American
yes.
Canberra? Yeah, and that was really stretching them. So he decided after the exercises to top off from a Victor and see how high he would go. And I think I've just about got to the point. I think he went to 86,000 feet. quite impressive. Quite impressive. I've also just finished reading Red Moon Rising by Matthew Brzezinski. And that's, of course, the rivalries that ignited the space race. So quite different, but really enjoying my aviation books. But what have you got on your table, Tim? You've always got something interesting.
I just finished, this is a recommendation from Roland White, who else, of Carrier Pilot by Norman Hansen.
Yeah.
Excellent book. Really, really good. It's in the vein of First Light, and it starts with a bang of his carrier, World War II. He's in an FAA Corsair pilot. His carrier being attacked by Japanese bombers, probably, I think, kamikazes.
Yeah.
And the carnage on the flight deck. I mean, it's one of those things you're just left white-faced and just with your jaw dropped after the after the first chapter, and it gets better from there. In it, it's really, really interesting. Some really interesting stuff. You know, just how many. How dangerous training was in those days, you know. If obviously the Corsair was a handful anyway, yeah. To land, and people were making mistakes all the time, and little things like somebody was flying. They were training in the US. Somebody was flying over Long Island, I think, and he had some kind of problem where the magnetos weren't misfiring or something. He brought the end of the aircraft down to a low level. And the supercharger was still running. The engine kind of put it back into life. The supercharger was still running at a lower level, and it basically melted the back of the engine. The aircraft just disintegrated. And a Pratt & Whitney double wasp, correct me if I'm wrong on this, ended up dropping straight to the floor, straight onto a crossroads on Long Island.
Wow. Wow.
The rest of the aircraft had just completely disintegrated because the aircraft was going, you know, supercharger, RPM. It had something kind of picked up. And those sort of like little kind of mistakes where you're thinking, I mean, hey, so many people had kind of died or been injured. And, you know, they hadn't even got into grips with the enemy yet, let alone. So, yeah, really, really interesting. And it's written like it was... It was just sort of penned yesterday. It's like first light.
Do you know what? I've not seen a bad write up about that book, and I've not seen a bad comment about that book. So I think that's going to have to go on my list. I thought I'd got through all the major Fleet Air Arm books of the Second World War, but I've missed that one, and I'm going to have to add that. So a good shout, good shout, Ed. I don't know whether aviation books are on your bookshelf.
Yeah, sure. I've just read the book, of course. Hammer from Above, Marine Air Combat Over Iraq.
Okay.
Started on that. It's pretty cool. It's good to basically see the day-to-day kind of attacks the Harriers were tasked with during that time. Some of them flying from Saudi and some from the carriers in the Gulf. But yeah, it's interesting to see how they were sent to different kill boxes or whatever, or specific targets they were given. And
do you get useful intelligence for the game from books like this?
Oh, yeah, sure. They'll be talking about how the lantern pod on the Harrier was very useful, so the forward air controllers would actually use the Harriers to say, go over there and check this out, you know, because they could... With the zoom on the pods, they could be quite high, but still mark the targets. Then they could drop bombers, GBU. Yeah, but you can see basically how they were used and how many missions per day they were actually flying, because they were operating from bases which were quite close to the border.
Yeah.
So they'd fly from maybe the carrier. Do an attack, fly to the short strip near the border, rearm, refuel, and be back again over the battlefield, and then either return the carrier or return back to the forward base. So
that sounds,
it just shows you how such a usable platform the Harrier is.
Yeah, that sounds like a really fascinating book, by the way. What was it called again?
That's Hammer from Above, Marine Air Combat Over Iraq. And there's also two others which are similar, which is AV-8B Harrier 2, Units of Operations, Desert Shield and Desert Storm, and another one by the same author, Lon Nordine. He does a similar book about Iraqi freedom as well. So, yeah, there's you get so much operational information about how they're used, you know, mission lengths or mission durations or how many missions per day and tactics used over the battlefield. Right. And how they were the threats that they were open to, you know, the infrared missiles typically. And whether you get lots of little nuggets of information as well, things like whether they would use chaff and flares on the attack, on the run in, or on the flight out of the target. Some people thought releasing it on the way in would also wake up the defences to you coming in. And others thought it was best to not do that and just do it on the way out. So, interesting, yes.
Wow. Good books. Excellent. Yeah, sounds good. Now, if you want to hear good book reviews, get some good book ideas, or generally are just interested in aviation books, do go over to the Facebook page for the Aviation Enthusiasts Book Club. And Simon's bringing lots of goodies to the table as well. And the Aviation Bookshop down in Tunbridge Wells is having the spring sale for the Aviation Enthusiast Book Club members, April the 22nd, down in Tunbridge Wells, Kent, is in the southeast of England. So if you can get there, that's a great event. And I also hear that the Aviation Bookshop is going to be at lots of events around the country in the summer, so do look them up as well. Okay, over to promoting aerospace. A few shout outs we have to make. Don't have to, we want to. The first of which is our very good friends at Threshold Aero. They are hosting the Gazelle 50th anniversary, the commemorative fly-in at Middle Wallop. That is, of course, the home of the Army Air Corps and the home of the Gazelle. And that's on the 8th of April 2017, so pretty soon. It's supported by the Museum of Army Flying and the Army Air Corps. And, of course, this celebrates 50 years of its first flight back in 1967. I think almost to the day, that is. Now, so not only are they hoping to get as many as 50 Gazelles at this event, some will be flying. The Gazelle Squadron are going to be there. There's also going to be some other aircraft as well. I think they've got a fair collection of Austers. They've got some pretty impressive other helicopters coming down. I know the French Army have now agreed to send a couple over. Over 50 aircraft on display and flying, I believe, as well. If you want to check that event out, go to their website. We'll put a link in the show notes. They've got a complete list of all the aircraft that are going to be there on the day. It's starting to ramp up. I know it's starting to get a bit busy. You can buy tickets from the museum through the links on the website. And we're particularly pleased to support this event. So give the organisers and friends of Extended, that's Paul, Andrew, Chris and Martin, your full support. We do believe that this is the first of many as well. So we'll keep an eye on Threshold Aero. Okay, I'm going to step into Tim's shoes here. I got a note from Brian Riddle at the National Aerospace Library, and they are in the process of recording many of the old lectures, speeches and interviews of the Society, dating from back as far as 1953. And they're starting to release them both as podcasts and as one-off interviews. Interviews with people like Colonel Pete Knight, Dick Johnson and Al White, and reveal fascinating insights into aircraft like the X-15, the XB-70 and the X-91 programs. Now, a few of those are already out. Some of them you can download directly from the Aero Society website. Some are through their SoundCloud feed. And we'll put links to some of those in the show notes, particularly those three individuals that I mentioned there. But Tim, I do believe the Society is digging deep into its archives to release even more audio. Very excited about this. I bet you guys are too.
Yeah, I mean, the ones up there already are pretty amazing. You know,
they are really, really great.
You know, Pete Knight, and also that the quality of the interviewer.
Yeah.
As well, as yep. Somebody who's asking a test pilot, a noted test pilot, and knows exactly the right questions to ask. You know, yep. you're getting really good kind of quality. So yeah, we've got those three out at the moment. We've got the ones, Sergeant Chuck Yeager, Fyodor von Karman, Igor Sikorsky, Sir George Edwards, Sir Bob Lewis, and Sir Frederick Hanley Page coming up, among others.
Yeah, very excited about those. And they are, this is all free historical programs that will be put out by the Society. So do keep an eye on the Society's webpage. As I said, I'm doing Tim's bit here. There's some fantastic stuff on there. Don't forget, almost all of their lectures around the UK and internationally are free. You don't have to pay for these. You can just register and pitch up and meet some of the most amazing people in the industry. So do check the Aero Society out. We don't only get Tim, we also get all this other content. And don't forget the library as well. A very, very early extended episode came from there. That also is one of the most amazing places I have ever been to, certainly in terms of making this program. So do look them up. Tim, apart from selling the Society, any other shout-outs?
Oh, you've done it all for me, really. I don't know. I'd say that we've got our upcoming Ballantine awareness, careers awareness event. That's coming up in 28th of April. It's a careers awareness event for 14 to 18 year olds. So if you're a 14 to 18 year old, or you know 14 to 18 year old, or you know teachers, actually teachers is probably the better one, and you can. You know, would they like to take their kids out for a day out in London and learn all about the exciting careers available in aerospace, you know, space, airlines, military aviation, engineering, MRO, airlines, you name it. Ballantine is the place to be. So, yeah, get in touch.
Do you know what? It's really sad. I'm showing my age here, folks, but I wish when I was 14 I had the opportunity to go to something like this. What an opportunity, if you're interested in getting into the industry, to have opportunities to go and talk to people and have feeder routes into the industry like this. So there's no excuses to finding those opportunities now. Do go along there and support the Society and the rest of the industry. Ed, any shout outs from you?
I'm embarrassed to say no.
That's okay. you don't have to. There's plenty enough there. If our listeners went and looked up that stuff, that would be fantastic. But if you're
surely Ed, it's visit cap to on Steam.
Yes, yeah, and it'll only cost you $30.
Well, there you go. There's a shout out for Cap2. But if you have an event you want us to promote or some local news from your airfield, then do email us. Get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk. Now, my colleague from the Airplane Geeks, Max Flight, has also created a new web page to allow aviation fans and av geeks get-togethers to be registered. So I'll put a link in the show notes for that as well. That's a great opportunity if you have an event where you'd like to invite other aviation enthusiasts along to. You can register it there. It's an international site at the moment. The majority of the opportunities on there are in the US, but I'm sure over here in Europe, there's a lot going on that people would like to connect with other aviation enthusiasts on as well. So I'll put a link in that to the show notes. Now, we currently co-promote the Aviation Historian publication in the show, as we have a reciprocal advertising arrangement with them. If you're interested in supporting Extended or doing a reciprocal advertising deal, then do get in touch. If you're interested in advertising, we'll help you produce the audio adverts, which is all included in our service. Any contributions or sponsorship that we do get does help to support us, and it does all go to hosting, software and equipment, and none of it comes to Tim, Gareth or myself. So that's it. We'd like to thank White Hearts and Peter Dixon for their contributions to the show. You can find Extended now on Stitcher.com, UKpodcast.com, thepoddirectory.com, and of course iTunes and almost every other podcatcher out there now. Our legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website, and please do ask before using anything you hear. This program is produced with a Creative Commons license. Tim, where can we find you online?
Okay, you can find me on Twitter at RES Tim R, or the Aeronautical Society site on www.aerosociety.com.
And in Gareth's absence, you can find him on Twitter at @Gareth_Stringer, and of course everything at Global Aviation Resource at globalaviationresource.com. You can find me at Nascot Hornet on Twitter and at xtpmedia.co.uk. That's it. With the arrival of the music, it's goodbye from Tim Robinson.
Goodbye.
And it's goodbye from Ed Skio.
Goodbye.
And it's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. Remember, stay tuned to this frequency. That is, of course, Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
Extended would like to thank its partners, Global Aviation Resource, the Royal Aeronautical Society, and XTP Media, for their support in helping to present and produce the programme. Thanks for listening to Extended. We'll see you next time. And don't forget, we want you to contact us. So get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk is the email address you need. Extend it.
This is XTP Media.